in New Orleans where everything is fine. All them cats is drinking that wine, drinking that mess.
I'm your host, Tom Wilmer.
I'm Sean Weir, author of The Mad Crush, An Obscure California Vineyard, and The Quest to Make Great Wine.
Going back in time, you went to Cal Poly?
I did, yeah.
Yeah.
That's how I landed down here.
When you went to work as a cellar rat, were you still a student?
I was, yeah. Mm-hmm. I grew up in Napa, Sonoma area, and did a couple years of junior college up there. And then,
did you have a connection with the wine industry growing up?
I did. It was part of the fabric of the culture up there. So when you were playing Little League, you were playing against teams sponsored by Sebastiani and Parducci, and then going to high school with a bunch of winemakers' kids. And when I was in junior college, I started working in restaurants, and that's when I got an early dose of wine appreciation, age 19, 20. Mm-hmm. And then when I went down to Cal Poly to finish up college, I worked in local tasting rooms and got interested in the actual process of making wine. So I actually left a little early to come back up north, work to harvest at Kenwood Vineyards, and then spent a year on the lam before going back to Poly. And at that point, it was the fall quarter, so I ended up working at Sausalito Canyon Vineyard for the 1992 harvest.
And that was the genesis of the book you wrote.
It was, yeah. That was my first tour out in the canyon, Sausalito Canyon Vineyard, an old vine Zinfandel vineyard that had been planted in 1880 and restored in 1974.
Some of the oldest vines in the state of California of Zin, right?
They are, yeah. It's the original roots still. They're now 144 years old and still producing wine.
Tell us the story how the Greenos found those old grapevines and how they breathed new life into them.
Yeah, the book is really, it's technically a memoir. It's my story of being out there, but I use that to tell this larger story of the history of the vineyard, how it came to be, what happened to it through the decades. So you fast forward from 1880 to 1974, and there's this character, Bill Greeno, who grew up in Montecito. He kind of burned out on the sort of upper crust life that he'd grown up in Montecito, ended up in the Mountain Drive bohemian community up in the mountains of Santa Barbara. Up there, they had communal winemaking. So he kind of got the wine bug with his neighbors making wine, kind of moonshine up there in the hills. And he had a friend, Michael Benedict of Sanford and Benedict Vineyard, who turned him on to, hey, you could do this too because we're doing it. Mm-hmm. And so he went on the lookout for his own slice of viticultural paradise and ended up way out in the upper Arroyo Grande Valley, off the grid, and he found this old vineyard. It was ensnared in brush and it had gone native, and he decided that's what he wanted to do. He wanted to bring that vineyard back to life and ultimately make wine from it.
That's so cool. Talk to us about Old Vine Zin and how those characteristics are distinctive.
Yeah, it's hard to put your finger on, but as the vines grow old, and in this case go native, there's a certain sort of aromatic complexity and etherealness that you get on the palate that you just can't get with younger vines. And even out there, there's a trace of what I would call sort of chaparral, which is, you know, sort of the native landscape there. There's a certain aroma when the wind in the summertime blows off the chaparral, and I could swear you can smell that in that Sausalito Canyon.
Wow, that's fascinating.
Yeah.
So classic terroir.
It sure is, yeah.
Yeah. And the soils, are they poor man's soils?
They are, which is good for wine, right? Because it concentrates the flavors. It doesn't retain a lot of water. And so instead of these big, fat, sort of flavorless, juicy grapes, you get these small, intensely flavored grapes. And what's interesting, I think it's maybe 15 miles from the ocean, way up in the upper Arroyo Grande Valley. I mean, it's got elevation. Mm-hmm. But the soils are riddled with marine fossils, which sort of blows your mind.
Again, these vines survived on their own with nobody watering or doing anything.
They barely survived. Mm-hmm. So the vineyard was producing fruit through prohibition for Sacramento wines. But at some point, they were abandoned. Mm-hmm. So for at least a couple decades, they'd gone native. And when Bill was out there looking around, the realtor brought him out there, and there was these sort of old stumps ensnared in, you know, poison oak and dry brush. And the way he told it is that he's sort of rooting around there, peeling back the brush, expecting that he's going to have to just rip these out and replant. And lo and behold, there's these little grape clusters. And because they've been covered up in the brush, the exposed parts where the fruit would be eaten by animals, but underneath the brush where the deer couldn't get, things like that, this thing was still producing fruit. And that's when he got the idea, hey, I can chop the crowns off but keep the roots and retrain them back up and create fresh vines from the old roots.
Did he do a head pruning style?
He did, yeah. Mm-hmm. The classic head pruning style that you see in every old photo of California viticulture going back to the mid-1800s.
Mm-hmm. And so through today, his son and family continue making wine from those grapes, right?
Yeah, they do. His son, Tom, right, he's the winemaker now. So you think about how cool that is. Bill's been out there since 1974, and his son Tom, I think, has been winemaker for maybe upwards of 15 years now, and Bill and his wife Nancy are still actively involved.
Oh, that's really cool.
And Bill's sister, Margaret, as well. So it's a multi-generational family affair, and if you look back to 1880, it started out with an itinerant Englishman and his wife who planted the vineyard. How they got out there, I mean, it's hard to get out there by car now, so how they got out there with a horse and plows.
And getting out there is only half the dynamic.
Yeah.
Once you're out there and you crush and you make your product, you got to get the horse and buggy to transport.
Yeah, yeah. How they did it, I have no idea. But and that's the cool thing. It's not just the Greenos, but it's all the lives that that place and that those vines have touched over the past nearly 150 years. You read the stories in the book, and it's not just me, it's not just Bill or Tom. It's people over the decades before us whose life trajectory was changed by these vines.
Let's step back to the point in time when you were working out there as a young punk cellar rat.
That's right. That's a good term. Young punk cellar rat. That's exactly what
and,
I was.
And there were some characters that you worked with that were right from central casting.
Yeah. Out there, they say that there's the right way and the wrong way, and then there's the Sausalito way, which I think is a very apt phrase. And I had the good fortune to be out there in the 1995 harvest. This is 3 years after I worked there while I was at Cal Poly. Bill called me to come back, and I threw everything in my truck, my Cat Road shotgun, and down I went. It was an opportunity of a lifetime to go down there and live on the property in the winery cabin. That harvest just so happened we assembled kind of a random team of cellar rats and other assorted itinerant individuals, and we all came together as a unit and just had just a great time.
Highlight of a couple of the memorable characters.
Well, there was Peter, who had worked there some vintages before. And he was a live wire, a jokester, drove the forklift like a madman, always good for a laugh, very hard worker, would show up late. But once he was there, he was totally on task and just a riot to be around. We had some people come and go, couldn't hack it. We had Adam, the drummer, who was, you know, maybe less into it than some of us, but, you know, he was a good guy to have around. And just, yeah, there was a whole stream of people who came and joined us, and ultimately we made a great wine, somehow, some way.
That's really cool. A little bit more about Sausalito Canyon and what they do today and what their lexicon is, what they produce.
Of course, the heart of the operation now is still the old Vine Zinfandel. They make a wine.
Have they done cuttings and rooting?
I believe that people have taken cuttings from them and planted their own vines from that vineyard, but I would have to kind of ask them the details. Yeah. But they do make a wine they call 1880, which is exclusively from the head trained old vines planted in 1880.
And that's an award winner, right?
Oh, sure. Yeah. Yeah. And then they have their estate Zinfandel, and then they source fruit from other vineyards on the Central Coast and make some interesting blends. And they have a little Cabernet planting out there, part of what they call the Bordeaux Triangle back in the day, because of the triangular shaped block. That was the only thing that wasn't Zinfandel planted.
So that's really what they're known for then?
Yes.
Is their Zin?
Absolutely.
Their tasting room, they have one, right, still? Mm-hmm. That's not where the grapes are grown.
Right, right. They have a tasting room out there on Biddle Ranch Road in Edna Valley. Easy to find. Cool little spot. I was out there for a wine club event recently and got to hang out with Nancy and Bill, and talked to a lot of the wine club members who'd read the book, and that was really gratifying. Yeah. The vineyard is a whole other story, because that's, to get up there, you have to go around by Lopez Lake and then drive out further and then come to a gate and go to a mile and a half down a pitted dirt road to get to the vineyard. So, you know, some people for some of the private events and tastings have been out there, and it was really gratifying to talk to some of them, because they've gone out there after reading the book and they're like, it's just like you painted it. So that's very gratifying.
That's really cool. And reeling back in time, the Englishman, why did he buy and create this property so remote? Was it because that's all he could afford?
Personally, I just don't know that story. Bill's never really told me any more than I know, so I'm not sure he knows or they know. Mm-hmm. But his name was Harry Ditmas. He had done different things. He'd been a grocer in Avila Beach. Some way, and for some reason, he found his way up there to the Rio Grande Valley into the area called Rancho Sausalito, which Sausalito for small willow trees. And he and his wife, Rosa, planted fruit trees and vines, lived out there and homesteaded it.
In your book, some of the areas that you focus on, which are closest to your heart, that bring a smile to you when you recall?
Yeah, there are a couple things. One thing that I really like about the book is that a lot of people have told me that it's the first time they really understood how wine is made from ground to glass. It walks you through that in a very approachable, unpretentious way, because it's very real, it's all true, it's very authentic, it's gritty, there's no gloss, no bullshit, right? So I was careful too when writing the book, conscious of people who may be wine curious or not even into wine, but maybe interested to know how it's really made and what goes into it. And so that's a part of the book that I really enjoy, is sort of spelling it all out as I experienced it and as I learned it.
So you've encountered some enophiles and venophiles that love the book, and some that knew nothing about that whole world, the backside of the story.
Yeah, I think that there are people who've taken wine tours and it's sort of gone in one ear and out the other. This book spells it out, I think, a little more clearly and a little more approachably. I think it's a book for not only people who are into wine, but maybe just wine curious. And I think it's a book for people who maybe aren't even into wine, because it touches on a lot of other things like California history and cultural milestones. So I would say a wine book that is something people who are not into wine might want to read is probably the ultimate compliment.
Within the book, there are certain moments where you can't help but to crack up and to laugh. And so at some point, you left Sausalito Canyon and you moved on. What tantalized you? What tempted you to leave?
Yeah, that's a story into itself. You know, when Bill called me to come down, my dad died when I was 21, right? Oh. So this is like 3 years on from that, 4 years on. And I've been kind of adrift in life. I was sort of aimless post-college, wasn't really doing anything.
What did you major in? What did you think you were going to do?
Well, I majored in journalism.
Okay.
I thought I might be a journalist and a writer, but after 4 years, I was a catering waiter, kind of living the Santa Cruz life, which wasn't bad, but I was a little adrift. And I think, you know, that maybe goes back to having that life moment that changed things pretty dramatically. And Bill calls me down there, and he turned out to be a bit of a mentor and a father figure himself at, I think, the right time in my life. So I'm out there for 2.5 months. I am working 50, 60, sometimes 70 hours a week. I'm living on property. I don't have time to spend the money I'm making. And I get spit out the other end 2.5 months later. All the wine's barreled down. Like I say in the book, Bill and Nancy didn't have to tell me or ask me. They were too polite to ask me to leave, but it was kind of obvious as I was starting to work 20 hours a week, then 15, then 10. It's like, all right, it's time to go.
Party's over.
Yeah, yeah. So I came out with sort of a renewed sense of energy and purpose. I think it was a boot in the ass just at the right time in my life. And so I came out of there, and an old catering friend said, hey, I'm leaving this place in Pebble Beach. I'm a caretaker for rent. Do you want to take my place? So I'm like, okay, so I've got some money in the bank. I've got free rent, and I can live in Pebble Beach.
Wow.
So that was pretty good.
Yeah.
So from there, I was able to focus on what I was meant to do, which is write. And so that was the moment I became dedicated to what I should be doing, and I turned into a freelance journalist pretty quickly, and sort of the rest is history.
So were you writing for magazines?
I was, yeah, magazines, newspapers.
And what sort of focus?
My focus was environmental issues, travel, and wine.
Mostly California-centric?
Mostly California, yeah. But I did a lot of travel pieces in Arizona. I had kind of a thing going with the Arizona Office of Tourism, so I wrote travel articles for AAA magazine, Chicago Tribune, American Airlines, things like that.
Nice.
Yeah.
Home run.
It was a pretty good start, yeah.
Yeah. At some point, you morphed and moved on from just being a freelance journalist.
I did. I had the good fortune of sort of taking what I'd learned on the journalism side through Cal Poly and through my personal experience as a freelance journalist, and then take that to the other side of the coin, doing public relations, which happened to be the concentration of journalism that I studied.
Did you go to work for a PR firm?
I went to work for a company. I finally threw in the towel after 3 or 4 years of doing freelance journalism. It's a tough way to go.
Yeah, reinventing yourself yeah, every week.
Exactly. So I took a PR job with an environmental company up in the Marin County area.
Mm-hmm.
And then from there, I got back into wine.
And somehow you got back down to Paso in the Central Coast.
I did,
yeah. How did that happen?
Well, I was at this job up in Marin County and wasn't liking it too much. You know, it just wasn't my jam. Like a lot of Cal Poly students, I wanted to get back to the Central Coast because once you get a taste of it, it's hard to resist.
Mm-hmm.
It's a common tale. People graduate, they leave, but they want to come back. So it's back in the day when you would print out paper resumes. And I put out resumes. I said, look, I want to take these skills and my passion for wine, put them together, get back into the wine business. So I sent resumes to a bunch of wineries. Winery from the Central Coast called. I said, let's go. Came back down and been here ever since.
So you've been kind of a rogue freelancer as a PR person, right? You're a hired gun.
I am, yeah.
And your clients might change and evolve over time.
Right, right. But we've had the good fortune. My wife and I have our own consultancy, and we've had the good fortune to work with a lot of our clients for 5, 10, 15, even 20 years.
Oh, wow. And you have some favorites. We were talking about Firestone.
Oh, yeah. I've been working with Fire. In fact, that was the winery that responded to me was Firestone Vineyard down in Santa Barbara County.
Oh, cool.
Adam Firestone and his family had started the winery in the 70s. Actually, Brooks Firestone started the winery. Adam is his son. Adam was the president of the winery at the time. And he hired me. And he said, by the way, I've got this little brewery in the back 40 of the vineyard, you're doing that too. Well, over time, brewery outshot the winery. They eventually sold the winery, and the brewery's going strong now.
It's going strong. Every time I go up 101 northbound, there's a whole like a sub-city south of Paso that's Firestone World.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's an incredible success story.
Yeah, it is, and still family-operated, second generation, like Sausalito Canyon. Nick Firestone's heading things up, Adam's son now.
How would somebody find out more about you?
You can go to themadcrush.com and go to Sean Weir, Seanweair.
Years ago, I read your book, and then all of a sudden it popped up again as a new book. So was it a rewrite or an evolution to it? And I remember there's a postscript about Avila and your connection there going back in time.
The Mad Crush was published originally in 2015. It's self-published. About 6 months after putting the book out, I was like, oh, I should have included this or that. You know, in an optimal, perfect world setting, I would have. But in the rush to put it all together, there were some things I felt like I left on the table. And over time, there were more memories and things that came to mind talking to Bill. And I thought, you know, at about 9 years after the first edition, I thought, you know, it's time to kind of do and put back in the things that I felt were left out. Enough time had gone by to breathe new life into the book, into the story. So I took these old stories that I'd left out and surgically put them into the existing book. So it's not a new book in the sense of it's something that I thought was just an even richer reading experience. So it added about 30 pages to the original book.
Avila was one of those.
Then there were other stories that I felt didn't quite fit in the original story, but I was still enamored with telling them. And so I added those to the back in a separate section called Prunings. That's where those little short stories exist. So they're kind of like a little add-on.
Teaser of what they are.
There's one on fruit sorting, and there's one about me thinking my cat got killed by a predator at night. There's one about Chamazal Vineyard working out there and some things that went on there. And then there is finally a little mini chapter on my time and experience out in Avila Beach and what happened there.
And that is a huge happening, isn't it?
It is, yeah, yeah.
You barely recognize it for anybody that was there in the prior iteration.
Yeah, I lived near Avila Beach when I was at Poly and loved going out there. And it was really a kind of an off-the-radar place and kind of funky and industrial and artistic. Then there was a persistent oil line leak under the beach, and finally they had to dig the whole town up, and the chapter's about what happened there, how the town was torn asunder, and how maybe it lost a little bit of its heart and soul along the way.
Well, I think what it lost was kind of that New England seaport feel to it. That's all gone.
Yeah.
They could have done a Disneyland version, but they went Orange County.
Yeah, yeah. You know, change is inevitable, but I think the reason I wrote that is because change came so swiftly because of this environmental calamity. So usually things sort of evolve and change over time.
Mm-hmm.
But in this case, the whole town was torn up, rebuilt, and reimagined within 18 to 24 months. And that's a highly unusual circumstance.
Once again, to learn more about your world, where would you direct us?
I would go to themadcrush.com. My name is Sean Weir, author of The Mad Crush, an obscure California vineyard and the quest to make one great wine.
Sean, thank you so much for sharing. And I'm your host, Tom Wilmer.
You've been listening to the Lowell Thomas Award-winning travel show Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer, a featured podcast on NPR.org's podcast directory. You are invited to subscribe to Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer on NPR.org, iTunes, and more than 20 other podcast channels around the world. To learn more about Tom Wilmer's journeys around America and the world, log on to thomaswilmer.com.
This is Roseanne Cash, and I'm sitting here with Tom Wilmer. Please support your local NPR station. I listen to WNYC in New York. In fact, NPR is all I listen to. If I didn't have NPR, I would feel like my lifeline to the world has been cut. So, yes, please support your local NPR station.
In there. One more bottle, if you please. We're going, it's getting rough. Come on, wine, wine, wine. Do your stuff. Come on, wine, take me for a ride. Send my thoughts a flying high. She let me down.